Hello, I'm Garni Barkajarian of the Pacific Neuroscience Institute and CNS member for more than 10 years. What I love most about being a member is access to cutting-edge science and the opportunities that have advanced my career. I've also gained new colleagues and lifelong friends. Being a CNS member has been so rewarding. The value of membership cannot be defined by a number. Join me and the over 10,000 neurosurgeons who are making a difference in the world. Visit cns.org/membership podcast today.
Hello, and welcome to the July 2024 edition of the CNS Journal Club podcast. My name is Catherine Holste. I'm a sixth-year neurosurgery resident at the University of Michigan and will be moderating the podcast today. We will be discussing the article titled Usefulness and Accuracy of Artificial Intelligence Chatbot Responses to Patient Questions for Neurosurgical Procedures. With the increasing interest in artificial intelligence, or AI, in neurosurgery, it is a pleasure to be able to discuss this very relevant article today. We are privileged to have the senior author of this article with us, Dr. Joseph Hudson from the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Hudson, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, hey, everybody. So I'm Joe Hudson. I'm currently a fifth-year resident, about to start my chief year at UPMC. I'm a complex spine fellow working with Dr. Okonkwo, Hamilton, Buell, Gerson, Agarwal, all the spine group at Pittsburgh. And this project was kind of an association with all of those folks as well. And some of our research meetings kind of spitballing ideas. But yep, that's me.
Thank you. As our guest interviewer today, we have Dr. Todd Holland. Dr. Holland is faculty at the University of Michigan and leads the Machine Learning and Neurosurgery Lab here in Ann Arbor. Dr. Holland, could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure can. So I'm an assistant professor here at the University of Michigan. I focus mostly on skull base and neuro-oncology. And like Dr. Holste said, I run the Machine Learning and Neurosurgery Lab. We really focus on computer vision, intraoperative imaging, and neuroimaging specifically. So excited to talk about this today.
Finally, all of our regular listeners will recognize the voice of our last interviewer, Dr. Kimberly Huang. Dr. Huang, could you introduce yourself as well?
Yes, of course. Hi, everyone. It's Kimberly Huang. I am in practice at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, and I focus primarily on tumors.
All right, fantastic. So, Dr. Hudson, could you start us off by giving us a brief overview of the article?
Yeah, so like I said, this idea really kind of came about a year and a half ago when AI and ChatGPT in particular was starting to become a household name. You know, people who didn't know anything about AI or maybe didn't have any interest in AI were kind of starting to understand what this technology was kind of capable of doing. And a lot of people in neurosurgery, including myself, and a lot of senior neurosurgeons had no idea what this stuff was or was capable of. And I remember at that time, I first learned about it, and I was pretty astonished at what it could do. I mean, you get on the website, you type in, write me an essay, and out it comes, right? So that was pretty unbelievable to me at the time. And, it got me thinking, where is this going to be relevant to me? And it became obvious as somebody who's spent a lot of hours in the hospital that there's a lot of, work that we do as neurosurgeons, and a lot of work that our staff does as neurosurgeons that could potentially be, a target for some of this technology. Right. So, one of the things that we have in our department is a sort of answering service for patient questions, where patients, call in any time of day, and if it's during business hours, the nurse picks up the phone, right, and answers the questions. Or, if it's after hours, it's typically a resident who fields those phone calls, right? And many of the questions are of the sort that you're going to be seeing here today in this article. So that was actually probably part of the impetus here for us starting off this project. And the premise is really pretty simple. It's, we take, 60 questions 20 questions, you know, in each category of spinal, cranial, and just general neurosurgery. These are questions that, you know, we thought up as practitioners that are typical questions you would get in clinic or on that answering service line, for example. And they're all questions that we've all heard before as neurosurgeons, you know, in the clinic or on the answering service lines. And it's, you know, how long is the surgery? You know, how is my incision going to be cared for? What kind of therapy I'm going to get, et cetera. And, you know, we split it up into cranial and spine and just general neurosurgical questions. And then we analyze the responses after just feeding essentially these questions into the ChatGPT prompt system with really minimal other input, just provide me an answer essentially. And, you know, then we took those answers and then we wanted to sort of qualitatively and quantitatively evaluate the responses. And the way we did that is we took all the responses that were generated to the questions, and then we created surveys that were sent, to a group of faculty at our institution, you know, five or six attending neurosurgeons who evaluated the questions on a simple 1 to 5 scale. So it was really just 1 to 5, is it accurate? And then 1 to 5, is it helpful? And then we also, you know, since this isn't just, you know, an attending neurosurgeon who's going to be answering all these questions, obviously there's support staff, nurses, et cetera, who are going to be doing some of this work. And so we wanted to expand it. We actually went up to our dedicated spine nursing floor, who has there's a lot of seasoned nurses on the floor who've, you know, been there for longer than many of the residents have, right? And, you know, these are the people who also answer a lot of these questions when patients are discharged from the hospital. They call back in to the floor sometimes in our institution, and the nurses on the floor actually answer some of this stuff. A lot of this stuff is also discussed at discharge. And so then we had them fill out those same surveys. And then also for the more quantitative evaluation, we looked at the, you know, the grade level of the responses. And a lot of the more quantitative scoring systems are based on sentence length and syllable length of the responses. And so we looked at that. And then, you know, the readability and actionability scores are kind of an adaptation of a scoring system from other medical literature that kind of tells you, you know, what can you do with the information that you're getting from patient education materials. And then there's also the readability, which is again a sort of I would say it's kind of like a surrogate for the other scoring systems that are based on sentence length and things like that. So really it's kind of a quantitative and a qualitative evaluation of the answers themselves. And I think the one of the slides here, there's a examples. I saw you had that on there. It's one of the tables. So that's kind of just a brief overview of what we did.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Dr. Holland, as one of our guest interviewers, would you like to go first with any questions?
Yeah, I mean, this is really impressive work, especially because I think that these types of systems are going to be more and more important as we're treating more patients. We see more patients that are needing spine surgery. And I feel like our capacity to be able to respond to these patients via, you know, MyChart inboxes is really not scalable. And I think that patients having the ability to interact with these sort of with these types of chatbots can really help sort of ease their mind, especially if they know that it's coming from a source like, for example, your neurosurgery department that you endorse. They know that the responses that they're going to be getting are going to be reliable and meaningful. They're going to be targeted. So I think that it's definitely a way in which I think electronic medical records can actually add value rather than just serving as a digital source for documentation. And that's where I think that's like the 21st century version of electronic medical records truly contributing to improving patient care. I'm still not completely convinced that it's done that much otherwise. So that's one thing I wanted to say about this. The other thing that I think is good and something to keep in mind is you know, as with the GPT series models, you know, they're proprietary. They're basically closed sourced. And that can be challenging in the sense that we do know that they're probably the strongest chat agents, you know, in the world, right, on the globe. So people are definitely wanting to research them. The challenge can be is that you can't really access them and you can't fine tune them. So that's one difficulty that we're going to have in terms of implementing these types of systems. The one thing that I will say, though, that is nice is that, you know, we often talk about in-context learning when it comes to natural language processing and large language models. Basically, what that means is that, let's say you do have a list of commonly asked questions, you could actually provide a document to this large language model that has some stock responses or some alignment things that it wants to be, that you want to be able to encode. So for example, you want to say, I only want you to give very conservative answers. And if there's any problems at all, or you're unsure, just say you need to see your doctor, right? That way it's not giving off the wall advice and hallucinating certain things. So I think the in-context learning can be very useful if people want to build a lot of their chatbot systems, patient chatbot systems, without having access to the model itself. I'm not sure if you guys had done any of that here, but it's certainly a way in which you can fine tune the answers without actually fine tuning the LLM weights. So anyways, I think that's enough for now. I'll leave it open for additional discussion.
No, that's great. We did not do any fine tuning here. I mean, this was just plug and play, right? So, which is actually one of the interesting things about it is that a lot of the answers were actually highly accurate and that they didn't actually include any factually incorrect information. Right. But, you know, the specificity of what was being said wasn't exactly, you know, what you would expect from a seasoned neurosurgeon, for example. And then you can argue that, you know, somebody further down the chain might be as nonspecific as well, which, you know, kind of argues in favor of implementing systems like this to try to decrease some of the workload for some of those folks. But
One additional point I'll make. So is the quote at the top, is that actually what was typed into the prompt for the ChatGPT API? Just how long will I need to wear a brace after spine
surgery? It's essentially a question.
One of the things, there's been quite a bit of research on this as well, is like, how do you effectively prompt, right? Prompt engineering. It's now it's a whole new field of research, right? And one of the things that we have experimented with and others have done the same is basically cueing the LLM into the role that they should be playing. So say something like, you, ChatGPT, are a nurse practitioner practicing at some medical center, right? I'm tasking you with giving advice regarding management of postoperative spine surgery patients. And one of these patients has given us the question, how long will I need to wear a brace after spine surgery? It's amazing how more effective the responses often are when you cue what role that it should be in. Because if you give it that, it doesn't know if it should be responding as a fifth grader or a neurosurgeon or, you know, just, you know, a person walking down the street. So the prompt engineering, when it comes to these types of systems, can be more important than one might think. And there's also been some pretty good research looking at medical LLMs. So these are large language models trained on a whole bunch of medical textbooks, comparing responses just like this to questions versus GPT-4. And what they noticed is that if you prompt GPT-4 effectively, it actually outperforms a lot of fine-tuned medical LLMs, which is a bit surprising. But the idea being that we have it on pretty good information that OpenAI has probably trained GPT-4 on more or less the entirety of the human corpus of text. So everything you can more or less imagine is probably part of the corpus that GPT-4 is trained on. And when we're fine tuning it on some smaller set, we're actually restricting the available access, basically memory and conceptual access that model has. So it's not clear at this moment whether fine tuning these systems for specific tasks like response to patient questions is going to be more effective than actually just using some of these larger systems with very good prompting and some in-context learning. So anyways, that would just be a follow-up point that I would make about some of the next studies that could be, soon to be done.
I think Joe's group actually did mention in their discussion, which was one of my points or my questions, you mentioned Quiver, which is one of, you know, many applications that, as to Dr. Holland's point, sort of you feed the information as opposed to just, you know, mining the whole internet, right? And that's a little bit of that garbage in, garbage out situation. And so obviously in medicine, we don't want any garbage in because that can, you know, affect the response to the patients. And, you know, my question for, I guess, for the group of experts would be, you know, at that point, you know, who should we be looking for these very specific niche areas, whether it's neurosurgery or these, you know, more even just medicine in general, like who should be the arbiter of this information if we want to really restrict that? Should we be doing, you know, kind of getting all of our information from national neurosurgery societies, from the institution, from the physicians themselves? You know, there's lots of practice variation amongst physicians, and some people hold what they do to, you know, gospel, right? And should we be just feeding an individual physician's things? Or, you know, as to Dr. Holland's point, should we really just let them mine the whole internet for all of that is worth? And so I think that's another good point to think about, like who is the controller of the information in these particular situations, or who should we try to get that information from?
Boy, that's a Pandora's box.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, I think that's a great point in the sense that, you know, we do have guidelines for a lot of these things, believe it or not.
Right.
Like, you know, basically the leaders of our field get together and they, you know, hang out over a weekend and they talk about what are the evidence-based guidelines for some of these sorts of things. And they get published in some journal. And then sometimes we don't reference them very much, right? We don't talk about them. It's certainly true in tumor. And I think it would be good to be able to have, you know, a well-trained chatbot, ChatGPT, but that is in a way able to take some of the highest quality evidence into context when it's responding to these things, right? The great thing about the latest ChatGPT 4.0 is that it used to be, if you gave it a question, that was a question that was to answer it was dependent on knowledge over the last 2 years. It would just say, I can't answer this. I don't know. I haven't been updated. I can't answer this. But what they've built in is now basically an ability to query the internet. So if you ask a question and the answer to that question requires some new information ahead of when it had been trained, it will just do a query on Google or wherever, and it will read off some of the responses, some of the hits for that query, and then it will generate the response using that context, which I think is a great innovation, because that's how, rather than just relying on the model to generate the response, it's using basically the internet as a knowledge base, right? It's saying, I don't know, but I can look it up. I'm going to look it up for you based on your question. And the looking of it up, we can control that, right? We should be able to say, oh, we actually only want you to look up these specific textbooks or these specific set of articles. And you can then specify if you are, you know, a spine surgeon and only wanting my patient to have recommendations based on a select set of citations, then that's something that may in fact be controllable using those things. So.
Do you think it's going to be the surgeons that are going to be making those decisions on what recommendation, you know, what citations are going to be? I mean, or you can make the argument that maybe the institutions that are you know, using these chatbot responses might want some input as well, legally, for example. I mean,
yeah, it would be a massive technological. Yeah. You can only imagine, like, if they had to get all of our input for, you know, what we wanted to be in the model, and then think about all the departments. That's a huge IT challenge. Yep. And, you know, just rolling out Epic at some institutions, we recently went through this. That was a massive hurdle for them.
You know, I don't know how your guys' departments are, but I know in my department, there's not always a lot of agreement on the right answer. So,
yeah.
Correct.
You know, it's, that's another issue that I think you're going to run into when you start to standardize this stuff. But
And I think it's a challenge for sure. And I think, you know, I do like this as a system to start to at least standardize some recommendations. So I'm not a spine surgeon, but I've heard that if you ask five spine surgeons what they would do, you get five different answers for some of these more challenging cases, right?
Yeah.
And they all feel very confidently about it. Now, I can't speak to that, but I would say is that what that really hints at to me is there's a level of variability in either the access or interpretation or experience that that search, the access or interpretation of the evidence and the experience of that surgeon. And I think somehow we need a way to form a consensus amongst all of these amazingly well-trained surgeons to be able to narrow in on, if there are five opinions, what I'm certain is not all five are exactly the best option, right? There's no way that there's sort of clinical equipoise between all five. The problem is which one is the best one, right? And I think that it's going to take a very complicated system to be able to address that, because it's not a situation where we can have all of these things be completely evidence-based. But I do think that there are ways to do better sort of prospective collection of data, but also obtaining better consensus on what are the best treatment options for patients. And mostly it's just been contingent on the surgeon, right? It's just, you know, I'm really good at doing these specific types of operations, so I'm going to stick with those, which is just fine. I think that that's a decent thing to consider. But I do anticipate there being a day when the treatment recommendation for any given patient of mine is going to actually be recommended by my EMR. It's going to say this patient does in fact deserve this exact operation with some probability measure based on the imaging, which I've looked at, based on the patient's past medical history, based on the current status of the patient, and based on all of the data available on PubMed, every textbook that's ever been written on neurosurgery and every article, right? That's where I think we've really culminated in terms of the capacity for sort of digital medicine and digital neurosurgery to really move the needle on patient care, because I don't see a real bottleneck to us achieving that. It's more about the implementation of this, right? It's getting medical systems to buy in to doing these kinds of things. It's a generation of neurosurgeons feeling like they need to listen to those recommendations, that those recommendations are things that should be taken seriously. And I think that it's we're going to be coming into a period of time where even surgical treatments are going to be recommended by AIs, and I think that they're going to be overall good recommendations that we should listen to. I'm not sure if that's maybe a bold statement, but I do think that we as surgeons are not immune to these types of recommendations.
No, I mean I 100% agree. Looking at the answers that you get back when you ask these questions, you really have to ask yourself. I mean, you can show this to surgeons who are, 30 years my senior, right? And just ask them, right? Is there any factual inaccuracies here? And I think they'd be pretty hard pressed to find, inaccuracy in what's being put out here. And that may come as a shock, and that's part of the problem, I think, is. There's a lot of people in medicine who aren't familiar with this stuff, and systems are also, I think, lagging behind a little bit. Although I don't know about your guys' respective institutions. I know UPMC is now a co-pilot AI that's I think it's a Microsoft product that's I think HIPAA compliant, and so you can ask it to do things like write notes for patients and all kinds of interesting stuff. That I think I rolled out a couple of months ago, but they're already starting. I mean, it's going to be here. So,
are they using any dictation software, AI based dictation software at MIT?
Not yet. I wish. Yeah. I wish. Yeah.
We're trialing some dictation software. It's very nice for a doing your clinic notes. It really does help your efficient, in my opinion. I don't want to plug anything, but on the forum. But I think it really helps our efficiency without taking away any of the rigor of what we do. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that with the increasing documentation demands, I think this is one of the hopefully most significant contributions of AI for the next 5 years is just automating a lot of the documentation, because I feel like that can really sort of the surest path to burnout when you're trying to dictate these notes and it's Friday night and Saturday and whatnot. And I just feel like that they, you know, with how good we see these systems working, sort of the speech to language and speech to chat and these kind of things, just very, very good. And my hope is that these will start rolling out sooner rather than later.
And to the point of this article, I mean, another really clear area of burnout, I think maybe even more so for our medical colleagues who have a higher patient load sometimes per clinic than we do, or maybe have just more clinics. They, as Joe pointed out at the beginning of this episode, you know, they have so many messages, my chart messages. And, you know, that's just like becoming a huge burden that, you know, doctors are not getting compensated for directly, right? And so I routinely see folks complaining about this. And so this is another area, I think, in the near future, before we get to that very expansive future that Dr. Holland was talking about, where, you know, they can dictate, or not dictate, but, you know, make really sound giant medical decisions per patient, right? That's the end goal, potentially. But, you know, even being able to deal with some of these MyChart, you know, message burdens. A lot of patients are sending a lot of messages now, and some health systems are even charging patients, you know, per message and stuff like that. So I think that's an easy potential next little step, you know, for LLMs and stuff.
It would save systems a lot of money too. I mean,
yeah,
a lot.
Joe, can I ask, do you all have a planned follow-up to this? Is there any future research directions you're hoping?
Oh yeah, we always do. One of you guys actually already hinted at it. The operative note writing. So you know, a lot of our surgeons actually use you know, templated op notes to begin with, and you know, so you guys have all seen the op notes that don't have very much useful information in it, and they're more for billing. And then there's also people who, you know, write a novel every time they operate, right? And in everything in between. And so there's a lot of variability there. And so for somebody to say, hey, can you have an AI write a you know, an operative note for a one-level laminectomy, the steps are going to be pretty simple and uniform throughout all the procedures. And if there's a maybe something unexpected or whatever, you can add that in as a sentence or here or there. But you know, and also there's the billing argument. You know, hospital systems are interested in making sure they bill for everything that was done, and if the operative note is missing certain things, that makes it harder for billers. And so there's another way AI can help out, making sure that you know, the billing is done correctly for systems. So yeah, we have a manuscript and already in review, exploring that. So
that's great. I love these very practical applications. I think that it's good. It's a great way to improve the lives of, you know, all the surgeons on this call. So
that's true.
I think one thing I'd ask too, Dr. Hudson, is in your discussion and for this article, you talked about the possible misuse of AI chatbots. And I was wondering how you would counsel patients and providers with the limitations and pitfalls of AI generated answers.
Well, I mean, obviously we're not, this hasn't been implemented yet, and there would be some legal hurdles before we start referring patients to what is essentially, you know, a Google type situation where they're Googling, and it may feel to some providers like that. And it's a similar situation though, where there's not a lot of inaccuracy that's coming out of this, but at the same time, I think we need to use caution here, because we can all imagine a situation where a patient who doesn't exactly know what question to ask is typing in something that, you know, the chatbot or the language model comes back with maybe the incorrect answer, and then they take that as gospel. And then, you know, I mean, everybody has seen this in a clinic before. You know, Dr. Google has told the patient something and they believe it more than what they're hearing from the physician that's sitting in front of them. So, it's I don't know if there is a right answer right now. It's a tough question. It's hard. I'm not sure what I would tell patients, to be honest. I mean, I don't know if anybody else here would, you know, have something more definitive to say, but.
Yeah, I think it's really hard. And you're right. We already deal with it day to day, right? Our patients do have researched a lot and they come with preconceived notions. And I think that's a little bit were to our benefit with our face-to-face interactions. And, you know, as physicians, that's where you sort of establish the connection to develop the trust. And obviously that sometimes that doesn't happen for every patient, right? They may never believe you more than Dr. Google. But I think for the vast majority of people with the right bedside manner and the right explanation, I think you really can, you know, get them to come around to your line of thinking if it is in fact different than Google or in the future, you know, an LLM or something like that. So that in that way, we sort of have the humans, not the machines, have the advantage. And I think that's still going to be true even within an LLM, you know, focused experience. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I do feel like, you know, with surgery, especially with neurosurgery, I mean, these are large operations. I feel like, you know, patients do still very much appreciate the clinic visits and, you know, speaking with a human and not just Google or ChatGPT. So, you know, I do still feel like we have the leg up on that.
Sure. No, that's not going away. That's for sure.
Well, you know, us humans can do that right now then. So I think with that, thank you all so much for a thoughtful discussion. It's been very lively, which has been great. Thank you, Dr. Hudson, Dr. Holland, for joining us in the podcast today. I want to also thank all of our listeners for tuning in. As a reminder, you can claim 1.5 CME from this podcast activity, and it's complimentary to all CNS members to the online education catalog. Thank you all again. I hope that you join us for next month's Journal Club podcast.